The story of Exodus is both intimate and universal, small and astonishingly grand. A man nearing the end of his life travels to Egypt, a place once visited by his grandfather, but a place he has yet to visit himself. Still, Egypt was not unfamiliar to him, for it was the center of ancient Palestine's solar system, the great object whose sheer size and weight exerted enormous gravity upon all its surrounding neighbors. Egypt was a proud nation, and justifiably so, for its history began as many years before Jacob as there are between the present day and the birth of Christ. After its first 2,000 years, Egypt could boast of many unparalleled achievements. A sophisticated system of writing, advancements in mathematics, engineering, and astronomy, and medical discoveries including new medicines and surgical techniques. Egypt generated artistic expression that pushed the boundaries of human creativity and beauty. The wonders of Egyptian society were founded upon a system of irrigation that channeled and tamed the mighty Nile, enabling population growth and the birth of cities, the likes of which had not yet been seen. Most staggering of all, rising above the ancient city of Giza was a mysterious spectacle of ingenuity and brute strength. The Great Pyramid of Khufu, or Giza as it is commonly called, is truly one of humanity's most enduring symbols, an object that leaps from the desert's horizon as if Everest was suddenly placed in the Sahara. It would not be until the construction of England's Lincoln Cathedral in the 14th century AD that the Great Pyramid would relinquish the title of world's tallest building. Therefore, the immense greatness of Egypt's tallest pyramid was eventually outmatched, but not for 3,800 years. It is to this civilization that Jacob goes and takes with him, the Bible says, all that he had. He goes in search of a son he once thought dead, and he goes afraid, unsure of whether he will indeed find Joseph, terrified of what might await him in this dreadful and powerful place. He stops along the way in Beersheba, a significant place for him and his ancestors. He offers sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. That same God later speaks to him in a vision. "Jacob, Jacob, here I am," says Jacob. "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I myself will certainly bring you back from there. Joseph will close your eyes." The end of that short declaration spoke to Jacob's immediate concern. He would see Joseph, his beloved and long-lost son, and he would see him before he closed his eyes for one last time. But God's statement also introduced in one sentence an event that would mark his people, for better or for worse, forever. God would go down to Egypt with Jacob and his family, and he would bring Jacob back from Egypt. But absent from this vision is how God would bring back Jacob's family. That story of return, of rescue, of Exodus, is the story we will tell this season. The Exodus is the story of a family that became a nation, the story of God clashing with Egypt's gods and their intermediaries and decisively defeating them. It is the story of one man uniquely equipped and called to lead God's people. It is the story of the formation of a people, the glories they witnessed, and the agonies they suffered. They would display remarkable courage when facing down an empire, but they would also demonstrate humanity's capacity for duplicity and betrayal. It is perhaps the ability of this story to speak to the universal experiences of humanity that is what is most distinctive and alluring about it. Few narratives in history have been as rehearsed, cited, or invoked as that of the Exodus of Israel. Sometimes it has been invoked to justify the competing causes of enemies. Its laws have been used as a rationale for slavery. Yet this tale of God's liberation of slaves and judgment upon their oppressors fuel the engine that brought African Americans to freedom through the Underground Railroad. It may have been a feature in the tortured logic of the slave masters and later the Klan members' reading of the Bible. But it was to Exodus that one Baptist preacher turned time and time again, just as many civil rights pioneers had before him. On the night before his death, Dr. King echoed the words of Moses, seeing a promised land in the distance, but prophetically announcing that he would not himself arrive there. The role Exodus played in American history is but one of its endless number of residences in the thousands of years since the Israelites took that first step in their long march to what God promised them and their ancestors. Most resonant of all is, of course, that other great epic of the Bible. The only story to surpass Exodus in its grandeur, scope, and effects. The Jesus epic, and all that it entails, is the greatest story ever told. There could be no greater. Therefore, perhaps the greatest thing that can be said about the story we will tell this season is that no story is as deeply connected to that greatest of all stories than this one, than the Exodus. It is the story of God delivering a people from oppression, graciously giving himself to them in covenant, and creating in their midst that which was lost at Eden, space for God to dwell with man. This pattern of redemption, covenant, and the manifest presence of God describes the Exodus, and it describes that which was accomplished in the life, death, resurrection, and ascension of Christ. This story is Israel's story. It is the church's story. It is our story. The story of God coming in mercy to save. It is the Exodus. The Book of Exodus, Chapter 1.
These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous and, if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, "When you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. "Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live."